You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
This hour, we have an ethical discussion and we ask the question broadly, but there are lots of issues to discuss under this question. Should we have greater moral regard for the interests of non-human animals? Now, we are a country in which many of us do love our pets, so we show them some regard, but we also a braai nation, for example, and there are many examples of animals often treated with exceptional cruelty. I was watching an insert from Carte Blanche just on Catch Up last week, how some chickens in the city of Joburg are treated in all sorts of illegal abattoirs, for example. Absolutely disgusting. And I could think of no better guest for this conversation than Professor David Bilchert, who really does absolutely amazing work at the University of Johannesburg. He is a great world-class scholar, particularly questions at the intersection between constitutional law and some of these very difficult moral questions as well. David, it's always a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and great to be back, Eusebius.
I want to link it to the last conversation. And this is how I'm thinking, that mom that called in that triggered me there, because as far as I'm concerned, in our schools, too many of our schools, we obsess with the reputation of inanimate things like a crest, like a logo, rather than prioritizing children. And it's almost as though we don't see children as persons that have intrinsic value and intrinsic dignity. By definition, dignity is intrinsic, at least as our constitution defines it. And we really struggle to come to grips with what it means to put children's rights at the center of family law. And sometimes we say progressive things like the rights of children are paramount, but we don't live it out. And now I'm thinking to myself, if there are adults out there, for Christ's sake, who don't take children's rights seriously, is it any wonder that we treat non-human animals as poorly as we do?
Yeah, Eusebius, I think it's actually very fitting that you've linked these two conversations. And we obviously have to think about them carefully and the connections between them. But what one of the things we found in studies, and there's quite a lot of supporting research that suggests that where you find child abuse, you often find animal abuse, and you find abuse of women. And vice versa, where you find animal abuse, it's often a sign of that there's something going on in relation to child abuse, in relation to abuse of women. And there are organizations in this country, I know an organization called CLAW, for example, that tries to integrate this kind of work, that where it finds abuse of women, it actually looks into the, of animals, it actually looks into the situation of humans in those contexts as well. And deeply traumatic effects that you see in relation to animals often translate into violent behaviors in some way. So an example that I was given, for example, I heard about a young child in a township in South Africa who really loved his dog, took care of the dog, it was his whole life. And then a sort of criminal gang who was into dog fighting one day came, and he was just walking the dog and wrenched the dog away from him, and then actually forced him to come and watch how the dog was placed in a ring with obviously very savage dogs who had been sort of brutalized and was totally savaged completely. And this young child was completely traumatized. And you can just see the interactions that we often fail to. We look at animal issues as separate from human issues. They're an integrated whole. And we need to consider that. And I think that's something that in my view, my approach is not, I'm someone who defends fundamental rights across the board.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think that we need to kind of consider these things in relation to one another.
Now, I don't want to bring you in to just cut and paste from our previous shows, although to be fair, your previous show with you was awesome, both here and at Power. You could just replay that podcast, because I also wanted to make it interesting for you. So one of the things I said to my producer is, please ask David whether there have been any interesting developments or any issues in relation to the ethical and legal questions about animals. And I wasn't aware of this constitutional court case, because of course you know that even jurisprudentially, while most of us, even if our behavior doesn't show this, most of us would agree that animals of course have interest to the extent that animals can experience pain and pleasure, it is good that we have statutes that require us to treat them decently. But what has sometimes been elusive, and I've only got one other mate of mine who's worked on this as a master's student at Oxford, he's now a brilliant lawyer in Joburg, Christopher McConaughey. I've come across very few people who've tried to wrestle with a bloody hard question, which is whether animals have intrinsic value. Because we can agree that I should treat animals well without me saying I think that they have intrinsic value. What happened in this Concord case? And where do you stand on the question of intrinsic value? Because that's a huge one to confer on animals.
Absolutely. And very, very interestingly, and almost surprisingly, we found a judgment that dealt with a case. And I think it's important for listeners to know it was about a case about a camel, two camels that actually were being killed in a ritual way. And basically, there was NSPCA or SPCA inspectors there, and they were having their throats cut. And one camel was having his throat cut 8 times and was really in writhing pain, as one can see from the judgment, and the other 3 times, and they were just going to let the animal bleed out. And the SPCA and inspector came in and shot the two camels to put them out of their misery. Now, the problem the SPCA saw was that there was animal cruelty that's prohibited in terms of our law, but the NPA actually declined to prosecute in this case, and it wanted to institute a private prosecution. And the issue in that case related to whether the SPCA could issue what's called a private prosecution. Now, we're not going to go into the details of that aspect, but one of the most significant things is that the Constitutional Court actually started talking about the issues of why do we prohibit animal cruelty in our society, right? And we have cases during the apartheid era which said, well, animal cruelty is really to protect human beings and having their human sensibilities offended. Right. And of course, that raises a real question. Well, you know, as you know, your show, I'm sure many people sometimes get their sensibilities offended. That's not a reason necessarily to ban something from happening. So there must be something serious that's going on underlying it. And another response is, well, if we treat animals cruelly, we have some negative impact on human beings in some way, right? But if we start unpacking that rationale, we kind of see, well, what's the relationship between animals and humans? Actually, that there seems to be a relationship that they also can suffer, that they also have interests, that they have experience of the world. And that's why there's a relationship between what we do to animals and humans. And so actually, it seems like we need to actually recognize that animals in their own right have certain claims on us. And the fascinating thing about this judgment is that is what the court did. If I can read to you, it said that the rationale behind protecting animal welfare has shifted from merely safeguarding the moral status of humans to placing intrinsic value on animals as individuals. Now, that is a far-reaching statement, as you've said, and it is something that it places our court in amongst the most progressive courts in the world at having said something like that. And what is clear is what we're going to need to do in South Africa is unpack what are the implications of recognizing animals as having intrinsic value. One of the important things I think that the court has done is it's signaled the need to reconfigure our relationship with animals in the new constitutional era.
That is absolutely stunning and fascinating. So we've gone from 1980s, where the rights of animals are basically piggybacking on my sensibilities as a human, to recognizing that actually, if there can be a point of view and therefore an interest that an animal can have, a non-human animal, then why shouldn't we expand our jurisprudence to give them their own category of interest and therefore rights that flow from interest? That is incredibly progressive. Who wrote this judgment? And it was unanimous.
Yes, Justice Kampepe. And it was unanimous, and the court affirmed this. And it's extraordinary that there was this this holding. And I hope that it's going to signal the continuation.
Yeah. So can I ask you this question then, practically, right? Because I speak your language as a would-be lawyer and as a philosophy student. What does it mean for the average person listening to Cape Talk and 702 from a practical point of view when we throw around philosophy and legal phrases like intrinsic value, etc., etc.? The Constitutional Court is asking of society to do something practically different in how society views and relate to non-human animals. What practically is Kampepe and the jurists calling upon us to do anew?
I think they're really calling on us to rethink our relationship with animals, and in that respect, to treat animals with respect. They talk about a caring attitude that needs to be adopted. So adopting a care, a relation of respect, and perhaps almost rethinking. We are often talking about, and I know on your show you engage with the harms that we've had from our colonial past, from our apartheid past, and the attitude towards animals and nature and humans, of course, too, was one of domination, of hierarchy. And in a sense, the court's asking us to rethink that. So you ask me, what does it practically mean? Well, I think two things. The first is animals don't only have instrumental value. What does that mean? That they're not only there for our purposes. So one major practical thing, last week in the parliament, there were hearings around canned lion hunting, right? And for listeners who don't know about this, it is a practice where lions are reared domestically. They are placed, let's say, in the veld, and they are essentially kind of domestic animals. And then a hunter comes, usually some wealthy person from overseas, and simply shoots those animals. Okay, this is what we might call using the animals simply for a human purpose, and a very weak human purpose, right? Just entertainment. I want to shoot and destroy, and therefore the animal's value, it lacks any value in and of itself. It's something that can just be utilized for my purpose. In my view, the intrinsic value idea says that this kind of practice in time is not, and even now, I think, should not be allowed in our country.
Okay, so you know I was going to go there, right? And now the phones are going to go crazy after the next question.
Right.
If animals have intrinsic value, does it not follow that killing them and eating them should be not only unethical, but also potentially unlawful? Isn't that the logical upshot of how far-reaching this court case has gone?
Well, you see, one of the important things about intrinsic value is it's important to recognize that we have often intrinsic value, and that allows our interests to be counted in an evaluation of interest, right? So one of the important things, just to make an understanding of why this is important, let's say people are engaging in, let's say, this practice around camels, and they claimed it was part of their religion, right? We know religious freedom is protected in our constitution. If there was no countervailing interest to consider the animals, then the human interest would always trump over the animals. So one of the important things of recognizing intrinsic value is it allows us to attain a balance between human and animal interests. Now, the question is, of course, in our society at the moment, people do think there's a case for eating animals. Many people think there's a reason for that. I don't agree with that, as you know.
You look healthy and fit. And he gave me a tell them what gift you brought us here to the studio.
Yes, I decided to bring a vegan snack for the staff.
Otherwise known as a nachi.
As a nachi, okay. Which is very nice and healthy. But the point is, I don't think it's a necessary aspect to eat meat. And I think that the interest in some ways in doing so on the human side is a relatively minor one, and compared with the interest of the animal in life which is a strong one, and therefore we should not do so.
Should we be vegan? Should we be vegetarians, fruitarians?
Okay, we can go to the exact.
What are you?
I'm a vegan, so
you're a vegan.
I eat. My diet consists of everything from the plant kingdom, but I don't kill animals. I don't utilize products that come from animals, which are crude.
Leather pants.
No.
How did you survive a sabbatical in Germany without any leather pants?
Well, you'll be surprised. Now in Germany, you know, you can get non-leather versions of everything, right?
So the evolution of your thinking,
right?
With this constitutional court case now that has happened, are you still a vegan, just a moral vegan, or is for David is part of your rationale for why you are a vegan, both the moral arguments, which obviously as a philosophy student I think is more important than the legal ones, but do you also now find that your logic for yourself is bolstered by constitutionalism?
Well, I think the logic underlying the worldview that I hold is definitely bolstered by the notion that we have to take care of animals intrinsically. I think we have to work with, and the law has to engage with society, and that overarchingly in a democracy, people need to come to to acknowledge and understand what the what holding animals have intrinsic value will mean. In my view, they're very practical things that actually it can mean at the moment. So even if you don't accept, if you think eating meat is a legitimate purpose for having killing an animal, you might well hold that that doesn't justify anything that we can do to animals in the purpose of eating meat.
Should I eat meat?
So what you would say is, for example, let's say in the production of pork today, pigs are confined in what are called sow stalls. They basically can't move around. They essentially are deprived of all their natural behaviors. And I've seen them. They're extremely miserable creatures who bite on bars. And that's not necessary. In many countries in the world, that's banned.
I think I might be discovering a shift here. Maybe you're becoming nice in your old age. Are you telling me that I should take care to make sure that the meat that I buy and consume, that the processes involved weren't battery farming, animals weren't treated badly, you've got sustainable farming, and if I tick those boxes, go ahead and order your pork chop at Tash's over lunch. I thought your position was, Eusebius, unless there's some reason such as an existential one because of money, etc., don't order the pork chops, even if that was a happy pig. Which is it?
No, Eusebius, you were asking me my position. My moral position is the latter, right?
Yeah, I want some guidance for what I'm going to say for lunch.
You're asking me about moral and legal, right? So there's a distinction between what the moral position is, what you should do. Yes, I don't think you should eat the pork chop. And the legal
even
position
if it was
of
a
what,
happy pig.
Even if it was a happy pig, yes. I think there's something intrinsically wrong with killing, right? Because I think animals have intrinsic value. They have a worth. They have a life that should be respected. So if there's no good reason to take their life, we shouldn't take their life. That's the moral position. At the same time, I don't think that moral position should at this point become the law in South Africa. What I do think should become the law in South Africa is that the serious harms that are currently caused in the production of meat, which deny the very being, the very value that animals can have and any joy they can have in life.
Now recognized in law,
those things should not be allowed anymore.
Here's my challenge, and we had this challenge the last time David was on, and I don't think any of you managed to defeat him, although some of you tried very hard. We flipped, if you recall, David, the burden of proof. Usually the obligation is on the vegan to make the case for why the rest of us should not eat meat, or in the way that he has just circumscribed, at least treat animals better in the production processes, etc., etc. Do you eat meat? And if you eat meat, can you construct an argument for why it is morally acceptable to do so? 011-883-0702, give us a call in Johannesburg, and in Cape Town, 021-446-0567. You are a braai nation. You eat meat. You won't get away on this show with behavior without reasons. What are your reasons for doing so? And can you construct a compelling moral argument that will make Professor David Bilchard goes 10 out of 10. I'm off to go and get my ribs after this program with Eusebius. You have given me something to think about and to chew on. Pardon the pun. John, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. Are you a vegan?
No, I'm just a human being, and I'm very surprised that I disagree with David. Because David thinks that the only living creatures are animals and human beings. Trees and plants are also living creatures. He must protect them. Why is he eating them? Why is he killing them?
David, are you inconsistent? You should be a fruitarian, not a vegan.
Right, well...
No, you must eat nothing. You must eat nothing.
No, but you know what a fruitarian is. Have you not seen Notting Hill? If it just drops from the tree, then something must happen to it, Moss. But that's an aside. Your broader point is well taken. Maybe you should get that clip from me. It's one of my favorite clips from Notting Hill. I can watch it over and over again. Just search the fruitarian clip, Abel. You'll find it. Mama, find that for me. You can answer John in the meantime.
Yeah, a fruitarian would also fall by the argument that John made, right? Because you can't eat anything which has is of living nature at all. The question is what beings have intrinsic value, what beings have if we
well,
talk
about these
kind of ideas.
Well, it depends. I know fellow moral vegans I'm not one of them. I mean one of your fellows. Who, for example, think that it's okay to eat roadkill. But let's not get too much into the circumstances under which you might even eat it yourself as well. Because after all, if you happen upon roadkill,
Right.
Would
it be okay to do
precisely.
So?
Precisely. But answer John, why do you plant their feelings and stuff?
Right. So that's very important in how we develop our ethics in relation to the natural world as well. And the point is that there's a distinction between those beings that have interest in their own right, that they have a subjective experience. So think about the table. Do we think the table has intrinsic value, or do we think the table is simply there as a means to utilize for eating on, for example? Okay, most of us think that it would be okay if someone decides to chop up the table. They have a table, they decide to chop it up. There's nothing wrong intrinsically with chopping up the table, right? People feel differently generally about other animals, right? A dog, you could kick your table because you're very frustrated, but kicking your dog when you're frustrated, there seems to be a problem with that. And there seems similarly, if you were to kick a child or someone in your family, there would be a problem with that. Why? What's the difference, right? And the reason for the difference lies in the fact that there's a being or an entity with a subjective experience of the world where things can go better or worse for them in their own right. Right. So it doesn't matter. I make judgments, right, about the table, because the table has no ability to make judgments about itself. And the same I'm going to say is going to apply to the plant world. Right. And it's going to apply that the plants lack a consciousness of themselves. They lack a sentience. And therefore, if something goes better or worse for a plant, that is something that we make judgments about. Now, it raises interesting questions, right? My approach about why we should still respect and show value towards the environment and towards other areas. And we can maybe pick that up. I know we need to go to a break afterwards.
I'm glad you've asked the next question that I was going to ask you, because that's exactly where I was going to go. We also going to take Meg's phone call, but let's check in with Aurelie. I wonder whether she's a moral vegetarian.
Yeah.
Lies.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Okay, some of you are now asking me, what is a fruitarian? With the help of Notting Hill, here it is. Listen closely. And please go and look at this little clip. You can just say fruitarian Notting Hill, because you actually got to look at Hugh Grant's face and also this woman character who is the fruitarian. It's even more hilarious when you actually see the clip. And I agree with you, Bundle. It's one of my faves as well. I've seen Notting Hill at least 10 times minimum.
Keziah. Some woodcock.
No, thank you. I'm a fruitarian.
What is a fruitarian exactly?
Well, we believe that fruits and vegetables have feelings, so we think cooking is cruel. We only eat things that have actually fallen from the tree or bush, and that are in fact dead already.
Ah. All right. Nice. So, these carrots?
Have been murdered, yes.
Murdered? Those poor old carrots. It's beastly.
I totally love it. I've got two questions for you, and then I'm going to unleash the listeners on you, because we've got millions of calls. Bry Nation, why do you eat meat? Construct an argument for it. And I'm going to stop putting the burden on the vegetarians to explain why you shouldn't eat meat. You must tell us why it's okay to be beastly, to quote from Notting Hill. Before I do so, two questions. How do you make sense of our ethical obligations towards the environment? There's a wonderful article by Martha Nussbaum that I still have to get into, that many of my friends have flagged in the garden, I think it is, dealing with how we have become self-centered as human beings, putting ourselves at, you know, the center of the universe. And I think she goes beyond just talking about our treatment of non-human animals, but the environment writ large. But then the other thing is, and I know this is a philosophy classic, but give us the radio answer, because this is where my caller went. Why should the capacity for pain and pleasure or having interests be where we draw the line? Why not living, for example? Because you get to draw a distinction between plants and animals only because you have quite a high bar for what it means for having your interests taken into account. By talking about having interest, being capable of having interest, having a subjective point of view, why should that be the yardstick? Why not existence?
Well, Eusebius, as you say, difficult to do in 1 or 2 minutes, but there is a biocentric view that actually does hold exactly this about all living things essentially have some kind of interest and have some kind of rights. I'm going to say two things. Firstly, I think those kind of views have a problem distinguishing between, on the one hand, whether I should have duties to plants versus whether I have duties to the table, like I said. So what is the difference between those two? And the second thing is, even if I were to grant that the biocentric view was correct, I would still think it was problematic to eat animals versus eating plants. Why? Because your duty would be to minimize harm, and the harms to the plants would be clearly, given the degree of sentience, etc., that animals, etc., have, even if you were to believe, and I really must say, I think that science does not bear out that plants are sentient or have feelings in any similar way to what animals do. But even if you were to believe that, there would be a much worse harm that were done in relation to other creatures, and therefore you would have a duty not to eat them, and we have a right to self-preservation. So the notion that somehow we must all die is an unreasonable argument.
What about animals, including some human beings, who do not, as a matter of fact, have interest because of all sorts of reasons? Are all animals equal? Do all animals have interest?
Well, as you've said, the question is, what is the ground for possession of interests, right? And also remember that interests differ amongst individuals. So we should have a look at, like when we're talking about children, we were talking about earlier, like a young child, it's hard to construct an argument that a young child has a real interest in voting or having religious freedom. Perhaps the parents have an interest in that, but the young child doesn't have the ability to assess or evaluate those kinds of things, though that child would have an interest in obviously not being subject to abuse, having their needs cared for, etc. And I make a similar point about animals, right? Animals, and also animals vary amongst themselves, let's just say, right? So a dolphin needs an aquatic environment, and we know that dolphins do really badly in SeaWorld and these kind of aquariums where they're kept in for shows, etc. We know elephants need space to roam around. That's why keeping elephants in zoos, for example, the statistics I read, African elephants tend to live 17 years in zoos versus 56 years in the wild, right? So we know that there are things that animals actually need, and that those needs actually differ, and the interests will differ, and that the attitude of respect or intrinsic value is one of treating individuals with respect for what they themselves, what their, in the words of Martha Nussbaum, you mentioned, their capabilities are, or what their activities are, what their good is, how they can flourish. That's the way in which you treat a being with respect. And let me explain to you that.
So what about some humans who are mentally incapacitated and will never have that? Right. Are we back to the 1980s logic that we must treat them well because their relatives will be mortally upset if we don't?
No, we must treat them with respect, intrinsic value, with respect for themselves, and with respect with the kinds of persons that they can be. And interestingly enough, I've written an article about the people with psychosocial disabilities as well, and looked at the fact that actually even some of the quite what are regarded as progressive views sometimes don't actually treat the people for what their own capacities are. They try and treat those people as the movement often is to try and assert agency under all circumstances, for example. Okay. And if you treat people with agency under circumstances where they lack it, my view is you don't treat them actually with respect.
Sure.
So ultimately, this is the understanding that treatment with respect is treatment with value for what your abilities and capacities are and your ability to flourish. That applies both to the human and the animal case.
Richard, good morning. How are you? How's it, Richard?
Yes, man. I've got a question, or a rather comment to...
Before you do, can I ask you a question? Do you eat meat?
I feel like Zinger Wings as I'm talking to you now.
Why do you eat animals?
Look,
it's wrong, isn't
it? No, it's not wrong. It's natural. It's nature. It was created. Let us take it back to the Bible before I do my analysis on this. When people were trying to catch fish, Jesus was there. The sea was dry, if I may put it that way. Jesus came and he made a miracle. There was fish. knew exactly those people are going to eat that fish. That is an animal. Hence, I'm saying that this is nature. It has to happen like that. Even in the jungle, lions depend on other animals to survive. So as human beings, we depend on animals to survive. We are living in a society of reproductive nature. That's why people must die and others get born. Animals die.
But Richard, can I ask you this question? Sometimes I have an instinctive impulse to give someone a clap. Does it give me a reason to do so?
No.
You know, some faces just look like they must get a clap. Does it mean that I must actually do so?
No, not at all.
Okay, so here's the moral of the example. One difference between us as human beings and other animals is that we have the ability to ask the question, should I act on my instinct? And you don't have to act on your instinct. Sometimes you may want to jump a hot guy like Eusebius. Then you have to ask yourself, should I act on my desire to jump him? And the answer is no. So you have the ability to think about your behavior and decide whether you want to act. So telling me about how wild animals behave doesn't let you off the hook, does it?
No, but you should be, and like I said, it's created, it's nature, and there's proteins in meat, there's everything, there's life, you know, there's health, you know. So I respect, however, the professor for his lifestyle.
His lifestyle, it sounds very deviant, very, very deviant. What do you say to Richard? Richard is invoking your laws of the jungle.
Yes, well, I think you've given the good response, right? Because I think if you, as I think a famous poet once said, nature is red in tooth and claw, and do we really want to read off our ethics from the natural world necessarily? Look, we are part of it to some extent, right? But our moral systems are not read off necessarily from natural world. So we know, for example, if you kind of have a look at some chimpanzee societies that have been documented, that actually at times genocide takes place, right? Now, is that to say, well, it's okay for humans also to enact genocide because it actually occurs in those kind of cases, because a rival group was taken out? We can actually understand our behaviors somehow by looking, because some people want to assert there's a firm discontinuity between the animal world and ourselves. That we know is not true, and the theory of evolution explains why that's not true. But at the same time, we don't want to read our ethics in that way, right? And so we need to kind of think through, that is, our ability is actually to think through, like we're doing today, what are the kind of ethical approaches that we should adopt to living in our
society? So this is a conversation for humans because of specific characteristics we have, i.e. the ability to think before we act.
Yeah, but when you say we, of course, also it also refers to people with rational capacities. We did talk about, so people also tend to make the mistake. They say all humans fall into these capacities. A young child is going to depend on their parents to make decisions about what they eat or not,
okay,
right? Because they won't be able to make that evaluation. So it really does, it comes to when we are hopefully in our full abilities, then we can make decisions about these things.
David, so what does that mean? When you see two animals fighting in the wild until one is killed, do you get sad?
It's an interesting point. I think obviously, I have a problem with animal suffering, right? So I think whenever you see suffering, I think we should respond to that. I think that's a kindness. And so, yes, my sense is I don't like seeing suffering, right?
But so
I
also realize no safari drives for
I
you.
But I also realize that animals, there's a natural world that occurs, and actually our intervention in that world makes things much worse.
Okay.
And so actually one of the interesting things, you asked me about some of the most recent work on animal rights, and one of the fascinating books some of your listeners might be interested, I think the best thing written in the last 5-10 years actually on this, is a book called Zoopolis. And what it argues is that
Zoopolis,
like a political community.
Okay.
And what it says is our relations and our obligations towards animals are varied.
Yes.
And our obligations towards, for example, dogs and cats and domesticated animals that we also used in production systems, etc., they are actually almost parts of our political community.
Okay.
Whereas when we go into a natural world like the Kruger National Park, they're almost like beings of a different country, right? They actually have their own autonomy, etc., and that we shouldn't really interfere in that. We let the systems work as they are. And so that's my view, that who's we have the, respect for those
I'm
systems.
I just want to get the author, because I know the listeners will ask, is this by Sue Donaldson and Will Kimmelicker?
Yes.
Oh, great. And Will Kimmelicker is one of my best undergraduate memories in political philosophy. I'll check that one out. Is it readable?
It is readable. It is sort of written more academically, but I think it is one of the most impressive pieces of the recent time.
Let's take a round of questions from our listeners. Why do you eat meat? Can you construct an argument to justify your meat eating? Meg, hello. Okay, I've chased her away with my question. Lawrence.
Hello. Good day to you. I'll preface what I want to say is a statement by saying I was a vegetarian for 6.5 years. My body started to crave a bit of meat, and my doctor advised me, you know, to listen to my body. So I reluctantly started. I would be a vegetarian if I could. I hardly eat any meat. It's very limited. I have, like with eggs, obviously free-range eggs. But why we shouldn't really eat meat is, first of all, the human bowel is very long. The bowel of a carnivore is much shorter. So meat, if you mix it with bread or other starches, gets kind of stuck, and it putrefies in the bowel. You see, also, when animals are on their way to the abattoir, 10 kilometers plus, according to a physicist, they know where they're going. They start getting anger, fear, adrenaline rises, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what you're kind of eating. So in America, they did a study, and the Seventh-day Adventists gave 300 very violent criminals. They were put on a vegetarian diet for 3 months. They were assessed psychiatrically and psychologically before and after. And they were amazed that the violence levels had dropped. So do you see,
Lawrence, let me just ask you this question. I mean, you're making some interesting claims, but before you, for physiological reasons, started eating meat again, what was your original motivation for being a vegetarian?
Well, I attended a course where they put us on a vegetarian diet for 5 days, and I thought, well, if I've done it for 5 days, I can do it for longer. And then yes. I met a lady who was a vegetarian, and she's been this for 30-odd years. And so, you know, I just fell in with the thing. So, but as I said, I would, you know, I would be a vegetarian if I could. You see this?
Okay. Thanks for your yeah. Vegetarians less likely to be violent.
Right. So I think we need to be careful about these kind of arguments. I mean, yeah. We also heard arguments made about health benefits, etc. I've certainly been very healthy. I do think you also have to watch what you eat. You know, you can have a French fries vegan. You're not going to be healthy if you just eat French fries.
In the research you've done on the health question, because someone on Twitter said, please ask David how often he gets flu, for example. Is there orthodoxy on whether a vegan diet is a diet that can keep us as healthy as the diet of carnivores?
My understanding is that, yes, there's no evidence to suggest it's any worse. And what I've seen, there's evidence to suggest it's better. There's a lot of talk about Mediterranean diet, which is also often very much strong in vegetables and fruit, which is also very good. But again, I'm not a nutritionist. I can only talk about my own experience. I've been healthy. I do watch my diet. I ensure I have a rounded diet. And I think that I recommend people who are doing so to do so. I also think, and I want to pick up this point that was made, is about what we call reducitarianism. It's actually very important for people to reduce your intake of meat. That can also really have a real effect on the industry, etc.
Okay, so you don't have to go cold turkey.
Cold turkey, and I think actually I discourage people to go cold turkey, because I think people often struggle, and then it makes it much harder to come back. So you've actually got to learn how to cook, how to think of. Many people in South Africa find it quite difficult, and around the world actually, to conceptualize what a full main course is without meat as the central plate. And of course, there's many answers to that, and you can construct wonderful food. And I've eaten really extraordinary vegan food across the world. But I think people need to have that shift. And slowly. You can't allow that shift to take place forever, but you need to allow yourself the space to learn, how do I cook? How do I ensure that I'm getting a decent
diet? When last did you eat meat?
Wow, Eusebius, I think meat's probably now must be what, 24, 5 years ago. Yeah, really? Something like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I haven't eaten meat for that amount of time. Fish, I had a gradual reduction. Yeah. So I ate fish for about 6 more years, but I haven't eaten. So, so even
I wanna, that. I want to take 3 final calls, years. But I want to ask you just one with your permission, because you know me well, so you'll indulge me. I'm going to ask you a personal question.
Okay.
Who did you first tell that you're a vegan, and how did they react?
Well, I think what you're raising is an interesting one.
I assume you had to come out as a vegan.
Yeah, well, I know it's an interesting point. I moved from fish to, I moved to vegetarianism. I was a vegetarian for about 13 years, and then I moved to veganism now about 6-7 years ago, and that partly due to my own seeing what's going on in being involved in issues around animal causes, welfare and rights. I kind of came face to face with what's going on in the dairy industry, what's going on in the egg production industry. Can I buy something really ethically? And I do think there are better and worse versions, but at the same time, I just, for myself, I found ethically I could no longer justify being part of these industries, and so I moved to it. And yes, I mean, I spoke to my family, and it, you know, it's a process of engaging with the loved ones around you. But what you said is very important. Many people have come to me and said to me, but how do I go to my grandmother and talk to her about my change? And I do think we need to hold people in that and actually speak and explain. And I had that with my grandmother. She used to love cooking a very traditional Jewish pie called a pirogan, which traditionally has mincemeat inside. And she was quite sad when I initially said I wasn't going to eat the mincemeat. But then what she did is she experimented. She understood what I came. She was actually sympathetic too.
Yes.
And she actually replaced it. She kind of experimented with different forms of soy and mushrooms and created a delicious mixture, which today has become the only pirogan, this so-called meat pie, now the vegan meat pie, yeah, which is now served in my family. So interesting.
You know what? And maybe next time you come on, it mustn't be 3-5 years from now. I think the last time we spoke a couple of years ago, because the implications for how we arrange our lives is an important part of this conversation. This is not just about ethics at an abstract level. I went to a very good friend of mine's birthday. If she's listening, she knows who she is. And there wasn't meat inside because her and her partner are vegetarian. And the dishes were absolutely fabulous. What is your policy on that? If you ever invite me for, I don't know, a brilliant share, for example, right, would you prefer that I don't bring meat into your house?
Yes. So these are interesting life questions. Yes, I it's part of my worldview that I want to not harm as much as possible, not cause suffering. So in my own personal space, I do not want meat. Meat is often caused by really, and people have to realize, like torture, terrible conditions that animals are kept in. So yes, I ask people not to do so. Also, many of my friends are very sensitive towards me. So if we go out for a meal or something, they won't order meat. But as you say, the braai culture in South Africa, people don't often understand that. But there's a lack of respect for diversity in this respect, because they don't understand that it actually, vegans struggle with that. If you have an animal on a sprit, it's deeply distressing to me.
They don't understand that. I think it's an intellectual curiosity.
Yes, yeah. And they don't understand that actually that's a form of, sure, it causes me distress, sure, and it causes many other people distress.
So fair enough. Meg, I think we have you back.
Hi, yes, sorry about that.
No props, go ahead.
Meg, I'm phoning from the NSPCA, and I just wanted to say that I was really happy to hear that you brought up the Constitutional Court and their ruling. They're ruling in favor of the NSPCA and the necessity of private prosecution. And it's just so indicative of the state of our justice system at the moment that they're not taking animal crimes seriously enough. They are overburdened, and we understand that. But the fact of the matter is, abuse leads to abuse. And if there is crimes against animals, there will likely be crimes against humans as well. So our justice system is failing animals. It's failing South Africa. And if we just see the huge mind shift of sentence just based on the Constitutional Court and their strong statement, that mind shift is going to take a long time to get the whole of South Africa on board. But if we take human nature, it's look at the human benefit and the basic concept of compassion. And if we taught our children to respect all animals because they are sentient, from the rat to the elephant, we will have a much better and healthier society going forward. We share your sentiment and your anger previously about the boy school and the abuse that goes on there. And the likelihood of abuse to continue because of that, it is exactly the same concept when animals are involved.
Okay. I want to take other callers as well. Just a quick one. I wonder how consistent you are in that in your own life. When last did you step on a cockroach?
I don't remember stepping on a cockroach ever.
Thanks for calling in.
To be perfectly honest.
Cheers. Miso, good morning.
Good morning, Eusebius. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. Talk to me.
Unfortunately, 1 minute isn't enough to provide a moral justification for eating meat. Well, I'd like to hear what your guest has to say about the following.
Okay.
Look, I think it's all well and good that humans have developed a moral framework or a moral imperative, so to speak. But I don't think that alone should override the nature and design of animals and humans. And what I'm getting at is this. The dentition of an animal, and by animal I include humans here, says a lot about the sort of food that animals should eat. Now, we know that herbivores, well, we know the dentition of it. We see the distinct difference between the dentition of herbivores and that of carnivores and humans. And I would like to argue that our dentition does indicate that we should eat meat. So that's it in a nutshell. I'd like to hear what your guest has to say.
But before he answers, and he can have the final say, obviously, sure. He's the expert on this stuff. I mean, there's an obvious logical flaw here that's similar to the first caller, which is that we have the capacity as human beings to ask whether we should do what we even are designed to do. We, for example, put earrings in our earlobes. That's not what Mother Nature had intended us to do with it. We put, rings on genitalia. Genitalia, presumably in terms of biological purpose, if you really want to be Aristotelian, that could not have been its primary intent in terms of Mother Nature. So our constitution, our build, all of those things are kind of interesting for academic purposes. But when it comes to morality, we will still be left to ask the question, should I do what I think Mother Nature intended for me to do?
And I hear you, and I totally agree. I particularly in the case of the caller that first raised the point that animals eat animals,
yes,
you know, lions,
yes,
eat
exactly.
Other animals. But my point then is that our moral framework, the moral framework we've developed as humans, is not enough justification. I mean, it does lead to questions, and it does give one the personal choice to make. But I don't think that alone should or can override what you were designed to be.
It's so interesting that people are falling back on these teleological arguments. I'm going to give you a full 45 seconds to answer that and give us a final thought.
Great. Just to say, clearly humans can eat meat. The question is, should we eat meat? And I would argue we're not hardwired to eat meat. I'm living proof of it, and other people are, and the millions of vegans around the world are that too. Let me just say, in relation to Meg's point, I fully concur. We need to try and build a less violent society. Part of that is understanding and respecting all creatures that exist in our society, developing a kinder worldview. And I want to issue in that last few seconds, Eusebius, a challenge to your listeners, and perhaps you too. Take one less meal of meat and fish a week and try and cut down and reduce. Mm. Try and cut down that McDonald's or KFC. It's not healthy for you, but also try and do it from a reason of understanding a respect for other creatures. Don't take your children to circuses. Don't go on elephant-backed safaris, and try and not hunt. And when you have a choice of milk, try one of those delicious plant milks that exist, soy milk or almond milk or rice milk, and try gradually and do that not just because it tastes good, but also because you're making that choice fundamentally to respect other creatures for the beautiful entities that they are. That's and amazing. That will bring something beautiful into your own life too.
Professor David Bulges, thanks for coming in. He is the professor of not human rights anymore. He is in fact the professor of fundamental rights and constitutional law at the University of Johannesburg. Thanks, David.
Thank you very much. You see you.